one of the last havens that Palestinians have to go to, you know, get away from, you know, their daily life and the daily lives of living under occupation, checkpoints, daily raids. And so what really, you know, got the galvanized the community is that this particular area, which we never thought that they would attempt to, you know, come to, they started coming over there and burning, you know, vacation homes, tents that the townspeople put up to go, you know, every, you know, Friday to go enjoy their time barbecue. And so this has been going on for several weeks. And so recently, you know, during the summer, a lot of the American citizens come to visit their property. So some of the townspeople had asked us to, you know, because the people here, as you know, echoing, you know, the other guests, the Palestinians here have zero rights. You know, they feel helpless.
Nizar, we just have a minute, and I wanted to get to the issue of, in fact, Saif didn't die when he was being beaten by the Israeli settlers, but the fact that they wouldn't let the ambulance come. Can you talk about that for a minute? I was just watching CNN. The CNN journalists, they smashed the window of his vehicle as they went in the area. Can you talk about what happened to Saif at the very end? We just have a minute.
So what happened is, you know, I was getting towards the end of what had occurred that led up to that. So we've been going the past every, you know, once or twice a week to reach the land, and every week it's been different. The prior week we had went with journalists. We had the townspeople calling the American citizens to go to their lands and just peacefully go on the lands without no one is armed. This particular time, some of the youth had ventured off into some of the areas, you know, because you have, you know, this is about around, you know, I believe 1,000 dunams of land. So some of the youth, including Saif and Muhammad, you know, as we were driving, you know, on the road, they kind of deviated and went, you know, to go to their part of the land.
Very quickly, about the ambulance.
The ambulance, actually, when we were going up, ambulances were coming down and they, you know, they were being attacked. Their windshield was smashed. You know, they were given no deference to you know, ambulances, to the press. And Saif, unfortunately, when he had tried to attempt his part of the land, they got ambushed. A lot of times the settlers, they know the area pretty well, and it seems like they stage their, you know, they strategize their attacks. And you know, he seemed to be alone with maybe another youth, and they got to him. I mean, he didn't attack them, he wasn't armed, and they just beat him. The autopsy shows head trauma to the back of the head. Well, and a couple of hits to the body.
Nizar, I want to thank you for being with us and our condolences. Nizar Milvus, a Palestinian-American distant relative, close friend of Saif Olama Salat's family. Saif's dad has just come in from Florida. The funeral was held on Sunday. And Jonathan Pollack, anti-Zionist activist, co-founder of Anarchists Against the Wall, injured on Friday, the day that Saif was killed by Israeli settlers in the West Bank town of Sinjil when protesting. When we come back, who's being held at that Everglades immigrant jail? Who's in charge of what the Republican politicians are calling alligator Alcatraz? Hundreds have been held there with no criminal charges against them. That's according to a new Miami Herald investigation. We'll speak to the reporter as well as Florida Congress member Maxwell Frost, who just toured the Everglades jail. Stay with us.
At the edge of the world, where the factories are, there's a burning of hatred that's crossing the lines. There's a blue-eyed devil man, thinks he's think you are. He plays us with his hate, turns man against man, but it's really not a game. And I pray.
The Demagogue by Lila Downs in our Democracy Now studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Democratic lawmakers are blasting the horrific conditions in Florida's new immigration jail in the Everglades, which Republican politicians are calling Alligator Alcatraz. After visiting the jail Saturday, the Democratic lawmakers say it should be shut down. The Miami Herald found hundreds of prisoners at the Everglades prison have no criminal records or charges, contradicting claims by the Trump administration that the people held there are the worst of the worst. Meanwhile, critics have called the facility by other names, including concentration camp, internment camp, gator grift, a reference to how the Texas-based company IRG Global Emergency Management gave $10,000 to Florida's Republican Party just days before it received a no-bid $1.1 million contract with Florida to, quote, provide operational support services in support of migration efforts in the state, unquote. DropSite News and others report funds from FEMA's Shelter and Services Program are being used to fund the so-called Alligator Alcatraz jail, estimated to cost at least $608 million. Florida's Republican Attorney General James Uthmeyer, a longtime ally of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, has been called the mastermind of the jail. The publisher of Florida Politics wrote, quote, in Uthmeyer, DeSantis found his own Stephen Miller, the far-right immigration hardliner and White House senior advisor. Attorney General Uthmeyer was appointed to that position to replace Ashley Moody, who took the Senate seat of Marco Rubio when he became Secretary of State. Meanwhile, Miller has urged politicians in Republican states to build their own versions of Alligator Alcatraz.
We want every governor of a red state, and if you're watching tonight, pick up the phone, call DHS, work with us to build facilities in your state so that we can get the illegals out, we can get the criminals out.
This comes as Trump's budget bill reportedly includes a provision that allocates $3.5 billion to eligible states for immigration enforcement and detention. For more, we're joined by Florida Democratic Congressmember Maxwell Frost, among a group of dozens of Democratic lawmakers who went to the jail Saturday. We're also joined by Claire Healy, Esserman Investigative Fellow for the Miami Herald. The latest stories headlined exclusive. Hundreds of Alligator Alcatraz have no criminal charges, Miami Herald learns. And is your family member or client at Alligator Alcatraz? We obtained a list. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Congressmember Frost, let's start with you. Talk about the trip you took on Saturday with dozens of Democratic lawmakers from Florida. What did you see?
So originally, we actually planned an unannounced trip. And, you know, I've done a couple of these ICE detention facility visits. Them being unannounced is very important because you see things for how they are. Somehow, word got to the state that we were coming, and so they issued us an invitation at the same time and same date we were going to go anyway. We still decided to go to see what's going on in there, and we saw important conditions, a lot of crowding, 32 male individuals per cage. These people are being caged, three toilets per area, and the drinking water, it comes from the toilet apparatus in the cell. Not only that, but there is not enough resources and not really an ability for them to be able to speak with their legal counsel or lawyers. There's not a really clear way on how legal counsel can go to the facility and meet with them. That's one of the questions I asked over and over again. I received the phone number in an email. I publicly gave out the email at a press conference right after. And now lawyers are calling me saying, Maxwell, the email's bouncing back. It's not working. And so there's a deliberate attempt here, it seems, to keep these immigrants and keep these people from their right of due process, of course, but also their right of even being able to speak with their counsel and their family. We've heard of the toilets not working. Yes, there's three in each cage, but sometimes two of them don't work. We actually heard a story of one night when one of the toilets backed up and started spewing essentially feces around the cage, and it wasn't until hours later till they were moved to another one. So it's things like this. Now, I will tell you, we heard directly from one of the lawyers who spoke with someone the night before we got there. Magically, they got their first shower. Magically, they got a meal that was a lot better than it's been before. That's part of the reason why these visits from members of Congress and oversight are so important, because it keeps the people running this internment camp on their toes. And so I'll be back at a time of my own choosing, a date of my own choosing. I don't need permission from Ron DeSantis to choose when I want to go, because it is a federal facility operated by the state. They made as much as that clear when I was inside of it this past Saturday.
And Congressman, who are the security personnel? Are they state officials, ICE officials, private security? What were you able to tell about that?
Here's the other thing. It's essentially a private detention facility. Now, no one will call it that, but when I pulled up, the people who came up to me to check my ID, they're from a private company, Delta Foxtrot Solutions Incorporated. Then I go inside. I actually asked this gentleman, because he had a badge. It looked like a police department badge, and I squinted, looked at it. It had the name of a company. I asked him, "Is that your company?" And he looked at me and he said, "Well, Congressman, we're a private company. I'm not law enforcement. I'm not required to tell you anything about myself." So I park, assuming, well, maybe they're hiring third-party security to do the parking or something like that. But I get into the facility, and that moment when they let us into the tent that has the cages where 32 men are squished in a cage and they're sweating, it was all private security dealing with the actual detainees as well. I barely saw law enforcement. I barely saw National Guard troops, and I saw a lot of private security and actually private doctors who are also handling the medical side of things. So it is essentially a privately run center, and people are getting rich off of the internment of immigrants in the Everglades right now.
And were you able to talk to detainees about their access to attorneys or their ability to communicate with the outside world?
No. There was actually two instances when I was looking to speak with detainees. And again, I've done these trips before. Usually I am allowed to talk with really whoever I want to speak with, unless they say they don't want to talk with me. They wouldn't even give me the chance. The first part, they said, "Oh, well, don't talk to people in the medical unit because of HIPAA." Complete BS. I've spoken with people in medical units before at other detention facilities. HIPAA would mean, well, don't go into their appointment and listen in, which is not what I asked to do. But then the second part is when they let us in to see the actual cages. And I have some people who asked me, "Well, Max, why didn't you just go in and talk with them anyway?" Well, they had about six guards physically blocking us from entering the cages. We essentially could only look at it. But I got to tell you, standing at that door and hearing from hundreds of people, "Help me, help me." One guy was yelling, "Call my family, tell my wife I'm okay." He started yelling a phone number. I couldn't necessarily make it out because it was too loud. I saw myself in those cages. It was a lot of people my age that looked like me. And when I was walking out of the facility, and I don't like to call it the name that they've given it, they're doing it to make light of it and sell merch, I'm not going to be part of that. As I was walking out, though, it hit me that I'm the first Afro-Cubano in Congress. I'm walking out of there thinking to myself, I'm going to be one of the only people that looks like me, that is Latino, that will walk into this facility and walk out on my own accord. And it goes to show exactly what this is meant to do. The administration is essentially trying to ethnically cleanse the country of Latinos, of Haitians, because I'll tell you, when I was in that facility, I didn't see any, you know, Europeans who've overstayed their visa or anything like that. It was all Latinos, all Haitian people, and nothing else.
I want to bring Claire Healy into the conversation. Claire, you've been working really an amazing team of people at the Miami Herald, where you're doing investigations into this Everglades jail. Can you just summarize for us? I mean, we got it from the headlines, but who's being held there? What are they charged with? How many men? We're talking hundreds and hundreds.
Right. We're talking 750 as far as we know at the moment. So my colleagues and I, we obtained a list of 750 people. The ages range from 18 to 73. And these are people from about 40 countries around the world. Half are made up of people from Mexico, Guatemala, and Cuba. And so they are categorized in three buckets, you know, people with criminal convictions, pending charges, and then immigration violations. And so we have not yet been able to independently verify all of those people, but there are about 250 plus in that third category, meaning they have no criminal convictions or criminal charges in the United States. And so also within each of those categories, those charges, those convictions, what immigration violation means can really range. So we've talked with family members who say, you know, of a 56-year-old Nicaraguan man, for example, that he came here legally under a humanitarian parole in 2023, and he has been applying for asylum. So he has a pending asylum case, and he was detained after a traffic stop. So he was a passenger in a vehicle that was pulled over by Florida Highway Patrol, and he is currently at the facility.
And Claire, can you talk about what is the 287 program under which this facility was built?
So this is a program that allows local law enforcement, and it's really been utilized in Florida. I think Florida has the most local law enforcement agencies that have signed on to this program. It allows them to deputize officers for ICE and immigration enforcement. And so what that means is that this is a state-run facility operating with the permission under this program in an immigration capacity. So this is an immigration detention center, but it is not, it is a state facility. It's being run by the state, which is also something that has led to some difficulty. For example, we have been noticing that this online government locator, an ICE locator that usually allows the public, family members, attorneys to search for their loved ones, their clients, using their name and nationality, that usually shows where somebody is located and people are transferred often. So this is a important tool for family members. That is not showing anybody at this facility. And one of the possible reasons is that this is a state-run facility. You know, DHS has said that this is the state. And so people are not showing up in that facility. And we've been hearing from family members, attorneys, that they only learned their loved one or client was there when that person was able to give them a call from the facility. And sometimes they haven't even known. Until we published this list, that's one of the reasons we published the 750 names of people detained there or who appear to be scheduled to be detained there.
Hmm. And finally, Congressmember Frost, you're calling for this place to be closed?
Yes, it needs to be closed immediately. The conditions I saw there are important. But I also got to be honest with everyone watching. A lot of people are, you know, now learning about detention facilities. I got to tell you, I went to Baker Detention Facility in North Florida. The conditions are also important there. At the time, I wrote to President Biden saying that place needed to be closed as well. Oftentimes, the thought process here is the conditions are so bad that as immigrants are trying to fight legally the deportation order, they get to a place where they say, you know what, the conditions in here are so bad, I'd rather leave the country, I'd rather sign my deportation papers, and essentially demoralizing people. I met with two Haitian gentlemen when I was at the Baker facility in Stark, Florida, and both of them told me, you know what, I've been fighting this deportation for 8 months. I'd rather fight for my life on the streets of Haiti right now than be in this facility a day longer.
Five detainees have died in Florida alone this year in these immigration jails, related in hospitals. Have a number of people died in detention facilities or related in hospitals?
Yeah, so I think we're at right now at a number of like 12 or 13 nationwide, and yes, about half of them are in the state of Florida. So, I mean, it just goes to show that the dehumanizing of immigrants here is obviously, it's not, the cruelty isn't just the point, it's part of the strategy to get people to feel so demoralized that they see all this going on around them that they choose to sign those papers and not fight it legally.
Congressmember Frost, want to thank you for being with us. Congressmember Maxwell Frost of Florida just went to this Everglades jail this weekend. And Claire Healy, part of the team at the Miami Herald that has been investigating this jail. Next up, Purge Palantir, the banner held by protesters across the country from Seattle to Palo Alto to Denver to here in New York, taking on the technology company they say uses AI to supercharge surveillance from ICE to the Israeli military back in 15 seconds. Exit Only by Deerhoof in our Democracy Now! Studio. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. This is Democracy Now! Human rights activists demonstrated in front of the offices of the technology and data company Palantir in multiple cities yesterday, from Seattle to Palo Alto, from Denver to here in New York, where the NYPD arrested at least four people who called out the tech giant for, quote, turbocharging ICE deportations, complicity in the genocide of Palestinians, and expanding surveillance of every U.S. resident, unquote. Democracy Now! Was at the Purge Palantir protest in New York and recorded and spoke to some of the protesters.
Across the country,
activists shut down Palantir.
My name is Sausan Samara, and I'm Palestinian-American. Over the weekend, we watched a lot of children being targeted, 13 of which were bombed while they were lining up to get food. And the level of inhumanity is obscene. So we are out here to try to stop it. Companies like Palantir are enabling these crimes. And unfortunately, this company doesn't work on its own. They make profit by contracts with other institutions. There are institutions. I actually know Palantir because I used to work for the INGO system in the past. And
INGO
international organizations. And we actually started using Palantir in 2014 when it started 10 years ago. Today, there are still international organizations that use Palantir, like the World Food Program, UNICEF, Team Rubicon, and then the CDC Foundation. These contracts need to break because the company is making profit out of the crimes.
So I was fired from Meta for organizing with my colleagues in protesting a lot of the ethical concerns that Meta creates in this world. I had this vision of an internal tech uprising. I felt that these tech workers that know the most about how this technology works, these tech workers like me that develop a conscience when they become aware, when they gain the knowledge of how much destruction these companies are causing, would stand up and rebel against their companies from the inside. This is my appeal to Palantir workers. I know it's difficult inside, but I urge you to educate yourself, to listen to all of these mass protests that are happening outside of your doors, that are being talked about in major spaces, about the destruction that Palantir is causing. Our governments and Palantir should not be working side by side.
My name is Daniel. I am a member of the New York Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression. The tools that Palantir developed using NYPD data are part of their pitch to other law enforcement and federal agencies. That means that that $30 million contract that ICE got, that was because they refined those tools here in New York. Those tools they're deploying in the apartheid state of Israel, those are tools they developed here in New York. They are more than complicit in genocide, apartheid, and racial violence. We know that state violence is the bread and butter of companies like Palantir. And as we've heard before, tactics and technology that are deployed abroad eventually come home to roost. the same data mining, surveillance, and AI-powered targeting technologies that are used in Gaza and across the world are now already at work in our movements, our workplaces, our homes, and our communities.
Palantir also announced a strategic partnership with the Israeli Defense Ministry. In 2024, a year into the genocide,
they said
this partnership
was for war-related missions.
In reality,
their technologies
have been used to surveil Palestinians
to gather their personal information
and to strategically target
innocent people
for genocide,
for airstrikes,
for rockets.
Palantir is not only complicit.
They're an active part of the genocide.
Liv Senor with Planet Over People. Some of the voices in New York outside of Palantir offices. For more on Palantir, we're joined by McKenna Kelly, a senior writer at Wired, focused on intersection of politics, power and technology. Her recent piece, This is Doge 2.0. We last spoke to you about your piece. Doge is building a master database to surveil and track immigrants. The main focuses of these protests were Palantir working with the Israeli military and Palantir working with ICE. In these last few minutes, can you talk about the significance of this? Founded by Trump ally Peter Thiel, CEO is Alex Karp. One of the points they made at the New York protests is he's a major supporter of Governor Cuomo to be mayor of New York.
Sure. So these technologies, after Doge first started working in government in January, I think we're all aware of the chaos that it's wrought. Federal workers have lost their jobs. Services like the Social Security Administration trying to access benefits have been made increasingly difficult. But out of that chaos, right, we've seen Silicon Valley tech companies or, you know, Peter Thiel aligned companies like Palantir or Anduril and other tech giants trying to find opportunity in this chaos. And in what we've seen happening at the Department of Homeland Security, these immigration raids, it's created a lot of opportunity for a tech contractor like Palantir to find a new client and use their very powerful software that is fully capable of mass surveillance in this country in order to find and be able to utilize and make a lot of money in government contracts.
And McKenna, we only have about 30 seconds left, but the significance of Gregory Baratia, a longtime Palantir employee, now being the chief information officer of the entire federal government as of January.
Yes. So something that is coming out of the second phase of Doge is, sure, Elon Musk may be leaving, but Musk-aligned people from Musk-aligned companies and things like Palantir are finding themselves in very powerful roles in government. The chief information officer was not a very sexy title prior to this administration, but it gives people in these positions have a lot of power over who has access to what data at agencies all across government, whether that is SSA, which has bulks of data on all of us, right? But also the Department of Homeland Security or just, you know, the federal CIO like Barbazia.
McKenna Kelly, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Senior writer at Wired. We'll link to your coverage of Palantir and other tech companies at democracynow.org. That does it for our show. We're hiring for a number of positions. Find out more at democracynow.org/jobs. Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Teresaina, Tammy Warnock, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamer Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood. Special thanks to Safwat Nazal. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain.
Did you know the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group, a.k.a. SFPERG, has been leading social and environmental activism on campus for 40 years? SFBIRD is student activism, by students, for students. Do you have a vision for a brighter future? Are you passionate about changing the world? Visit us at www.sfbird.ca. That's www.sfbird.ca to learn more about getting involved today.
Radio Rewind.